Good morning, everyone. Monday morning, April 21st. And here again, the news at home and abroad. Our reporters in London and Berlin are standing by, and a little later on, we'll hear the news in Washington as given by Earl Godwin. But first, overseas to London.
This is John McVane in London. Air activity over Britain last night was slight. A few bombs were dropped in the east and southwest of England, but they are said to have caused no damage. London had a very short raid alarm, but no bombs were reported. British bombers last night carried out operations over western Germany in the invasion ports. Pilots reported bad weather conditions over the continent. The Admiralty announced this morning that a fully loaded enemy tanker on its way to Tripoli has been sunk by the British submarine Tetrarch. There is no news from Greece today except the statement by the Greek High Command that the Germans hadn't broken through the Greek lines, which were modified according to plan. Reports reaching London from Libya say that the Germans have made 7 attacks on Tobruk since the siege began. In the attack mentioned in yesterday's communique, the German tanks took the same route taken by the British when they captured Tobruk in January. 12 of the tanks penetrated the outer defenses, but were driven off after 4 had been put out of action. An Australian soldier put one of the tanks out of action by crawling up to it on the blind side and sticking a piece of iron in the caterpillar track. German infantry that was following the tanks dispersed and withdrew 800 yards from the outer barbed wire when British artillery began shelling them. British military experts believe that the British and Greek forces will continue their withdrawal in Greece until they have formed a line reaching from the Gulf of Lamia in the east to the Gulf of Arta in the west. It is pointed out that this front would be less than 70 miles wide from sea to sea. That is less than half the size of the present front. 3/4 of it is impassable mountain land, and only one winding road goes through it, the road to Athens. Some hope is expressed here that for a time the Allies will be able to hold a somewhat longer front, whose right wing would hinge on Volos, 50 miles south of Larissa. Writing in the Daily Mail of the Lamia-Arta front, Captain Little Hart, the British military expert, says that more cover would be provided if the right wing lay along the range just north of the Gulf of Lamia, although the line itself would be shorter and stronger if the right flank rested south of the Gulf near the historic pass of Thermopylae. The flaw in such a line, as Captain Little Hart sees it, would be that the Allies would almost literally have their backs to the wall, that is, the Gulf of Corinth, 30 miles south. If the line were pierced, it would be difficult to get the Allied forces away safely by a sidestepping movement eastward. If the Allied commanders do form their right wing at Thermopylae, they will be turning back the pages of history. As you probably remember, it was at the pass of Thermopylae that Leonidas and his 300 Spartans stopped the onslaught of the Persian host until a fifth colonist, a traitor as they used to call him, led the Persians around to the Spartans' rear by a secret mountain path. Captain Little Hart believes that in the attack on Egypt, the Germans may use a sweeping movement far to the south by way of the Siwa Oasis against the Nile Valley. He points out that desert fighting has tended to become more like naval warfare than land warfare, and he notes that although such a movement would be risky, the Germans have a fondness for the type of daring that involves risking natural hazards rather than meeting concentrated resistance of the type they would presumably meet in a direct attack toward Mersa Matru. Many London families are continuing to live in badly bombed houses. One London paper sent a reporter around yesterday to find out how such families were carrying on. In one street that had been badly bombed in Wednesday night's big raid, the reporter found families sitting down to Sunday dinners of lamb, roast potatoes, and greens, in spite of the fact that they had no gas. A housewife explained that she had cooked the dinner on an open fire made from bits of wood salvaged from bombed houses. The whole family is living and sleeping in the one room of the house that hasn't been destroyed. Nearby, another family is living in the kitchen, in a block of flats whose side was ripped open by a bomb. A third family is living on the top floor. The father of the family is quoted as saying, "We are staying put the way Mr. Churchill wants us to." London professors of the tattooing art say that war has brought a boom in tattooed women. Girls serving with the women's forces look on tattoo marks as the best means of identification. So they put the crests of their services and their identification number is tattooed where they won't show when the girls wear evening dresses. One London tattooist says that his wartime women customers far outnumber the men. Lowe, the cartoonist, today bases his cartoon on reports that Colonel Lindbergh has been telling American audiences that Britain is defeated. Lo pictures Lindbergh as a black-garbed undertaker bearing a huge wreath. A black-bordered card on the wreath says, "In memory of the dead British." In a bomb-battered doorway stands a grinning British Tommy in full battle kit. And the Tommy is saying, "Sorry, the report is greatly exaggerated." This is John McVane in London, returning you to the National Broadcasting Company in New York.
And that's the report from England on this morning's news roundup. Next, our reporter in the Reich reports on affairs in Germany. Go ahead, Berlin.
Hello, NBC. This is Theodor Knaut speaking from Berlin. In Greece, the Germans have penetrated far beyond Larissa in pursuit of the enemy, the bulletin of the High Command reports. And in another section have taken the Metsovon Pass to the west of the Pindus Mountains. In Albania, the Italians have in many places reached the Greek frontier. The German air forces have been very active in harassing the British and Greek retreat, the congested roads offering them many targets, and a transport was sunk off the east coast of Greece. The 7,000-ton ship is claimed sunk in the harbor of Volos, and two more were struck at Chalkis. German pursuit planes shot down six Britishers without loss in yesterday's fighting. In Africa, attacks on Salum and from Tobruk were repulsed, and four hurricanes were shot down. In Scotland, a factory was bombed, and the British flew into western and northwestern Germany with what are described as weak forces only. They hit only dwellings and killed only civilians, it is stated, and lost one of their own planes shot down by German flak. In Croatia, a German bicycle squadron is reported to have captured a Yugoslav divisional staff and therewith compelled the surrender of 12,000 men. The Essener Nationalzeitung, in commenting on the military situation in Greece, emphasizes that the passes that held up the German advance are now in their hands and that a quick decision is coming. The last line of resistance that stands before Athens itself is the famous Pass of Thermopylae, which, so the paper tells us, Leonidas himself could not defend against the Persians, although he sacrificed all his army to do so. The death of the Greek premier Corytzis is universally admitted here to be due to murder by the British, and references are made to the death of Metaxas and of several Egyptian statesmen as evidence of the way the British get rid of their opponents when they stand in their way. Winston Churchill's telegram of condolence to the Greek government is taken as a particularly revolting bit of hypocrisy, for Churchill himself, as every German knows, was himself the murderer. Germany's first minister to the newly recognized state of Croatia is a high officer in the Stormtroop organization, by name Siegfried Kascher, and hitherto in command at Hamburg. He was heartily welcomed on his arrival at Zagreb by the heads of the new state. One of the first acts of the new government in Croatia has been the organization of a tribunal that will mete out justice in cases of opposition to the new regime. The Royal Italian Opera of Rome is playing a return engagement here, and the opening performance was made a gala one, all the leading officials in Berlin attending with the representatives of the three power-packed nations. The Berlin State Opera House is out of business for the time being, but that never bothered Berlin for a minute, as it had a second opera house available, and this one in Charlottenburg is the one in which the Italian guests are housed. The disclosure by Pravda that Russia had twice been asked to join the three-power pact has excited discussion here, but no comment is made because Russia preferred a separate pact with Japan. The article goes on to deny the comment made in America that the Russo-Japanese pact is directed against Germany. Count Czarno is understood to be on his way to Germany, where he will meet with Foreign Minister von Ribbentrop, presumably to discuss the boundaries of the new Croatian state and similar questions arising from the destruction of Yugoslavia. Representatives of the states bordering on Yugoslavia are expected to be present too, where their interests are affected. It also is reported that King Boris of Bulgaria has had an interview with Adolf Hitler on the occasion of his birthday. From Vichy comes an unconfirmed report that Laval is to be in on a new cabinet shuffle. It is known that Admiral Dallard has been seeing Germany's ambassador Abetz, and the discussions are said to have been of a positive nature, but that is all that is divulged here. Rations are being reduced in Holland, according to the German paper in the Netherlands, the items most affected being butter, milk, meat, and potatoes. The reason given why Holland, formerly such a great exporter of dairy products, is now short of milk and butter is said to be the shortage of fodder from abroad without which the cows cannot do their stuff. The paper goes on to say that many Hollanders had resorted to milk drinking in this time of food shortage. This is Theodor Knaut speaking from Berlin and returning you to NBC.
And now here's Earl Godwin reporting from the NBC newsroom in Washington.
Good morning, folks. Red Cross news pours from Washington across the world today as the annual convention opens, and already I have predicted this, and the president has now endorsed the appeal for at least 1,000 American physicians to volunteer for active service with Britain's Royal Army Medical Corps, and the call was made on behalf of the British Red Cross. We come very close to a practical hand in alliance with Canada. The matter which will have Washington's first attention today is the agreement between the President Roosevelt and Prime Minister Mackenzie King, which appears to be a plan to pool the industrial and financial resources of the two countries for defense purposes. The countries already have a joint agreement for unified military and naval defense against aggression. Now comes a plan that seems to wipe out the economic boundary lines. We have many things that Canada needs. Canada has some things we need. An outstanding need on our part is aluminum, which Canada can and will furnish. We also will be shipping Canada much more than usual in the way of manufactured articles. If this plan is okayed by the heads of the two nations, is acceptable, and I suppose it will be, congressional leaders are going to be informed about it today. That's the important and glamorous item on the agenda. The headache is still strikes. The coal strike situation seems to me to be exactly like a donkey with a wisp of straw always in front of his nose. He never gets it. And we never get the news of that break in the strike, which is always ahead of us. This is Monday. The president said Friday he hoped to see some mines opened and at work today. There is a tremendous lot of undercover wire pulling here today to get an early end of this dispute. But so far, the appeal of Francis Perkins, Secretary of Labor, has seemed gone disregarded. Unless the mines are opened this week, there will be a definite slowdown on defense industries in spots at least. Also, that General Motors strike is looming. The president is reported to be planning to take a hand in that too. And incidentally, the president had a silent and, I'm told, effective part in the steel situation recently. And I think you can expect some violent repercussions on Capitol Hill in Congress over what Member Smith of the National Labor Relations Board had to say yesterday before the National Federation for Constitutional Liberties. That is an organization which fought the Selective Service Act and which harmonizes with the group known as the American Peace Mobilization, which in turn is described by its opponents, particularly the Dyes Committee, as a front for Moscow. Mr. Smith, who, as I say, is a member of the National Labor Relations Board, attacked the anti-strike program in Congress, predicted fascism in this country unless congressional anti-strike members are curbed. He laughed at the so-called communist bogey and said the defense of democracy should include a defense against those in Congress, in government, who are responsible only to what he termed special privilege. The meeting at which Mr. Smith, federal official, spoke also heard a rip-snorting speech from communist Christoffel, who led the Alice Chalmers strike, and who referred to Secretary Knox of the Navy and William Knudsen, his name begins with a K, as our friends the KK. This meeting also sang a song in which one line was, "The workers know their bosses are their greatest enemy." My only reason in reporting that is because it's going to make hot news on Capitol Hill today. And Earl Godwin says goodbye. That's all from Washington at this time.
And that's the news at home and abroad. Keep tuned to this station for the latest news. This is the National Broadcasting Company.